So we've all heard of haunted places, but sometimes hauntings take place on a much smaller and mobile scale. In this episode, we share two creepy stories involving haunted objects. Welcome to Shadowland, everybody.
Welcome.
This is a podcast that shines a spotlight on stories of the supernatural, mysterious, eerie, and unexplained. So, stuff like...
Stargates.
Cults.
Sprites.
Creepypasta.
Sex magic.
Doppelgangers.
Vampires.
Celebrity doppelgangers.
Ooh, I like that one. Underground cities.
Mothman.
Trolls. Did I say
Hauntings that? At seas.
Time travelers.
Telepathy.
Giants. All that sort of stuff.
All of it. And more.
And more. Cool. So, I guess should we introduce ourselves?
Yes. I'm Christina Callery.
And I'm Seth Jablon. And yeah, we're here to talk about all types of weird stuff. Paranormal, interesting. Anything we find interesting or weird or creepy. It's all the sort of stuff we like to talk about with each other and just, like, make it a discussion, share stories, but not really try to, like, conclude or prove anything. Just, like, you know, just talk about it.
Yeah, just hearing the stories is the big part of the fun. And we want to hear your shadowy stories, too, and also suggestions for future episodes. So if there's something you think about or you have, like, a really great story, please email to shadowlandpodcast@gmail.com.
Cool. All right. Let's see. Do you want me to go first? Mine's long, so do you want me to go first?
Yeah, I think I went first last time, so you should go first.
Okay.
So this week, everybody, we've got a fun one. We're doing haunted objects.
Haunted objects, yes. Cool. So I've got a whopper of the haunted object category. I don't know if you know this one, but it's a big one. I'm sure, like, most of the diehard paranormal people already know it, but for those who don't, it's a pretty interesting story. It's a pretty great saga. And it's the story of the Dybbuk box. Do you know the story?
Oh, I've heard about it.
You've heard about it. Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to do the
whole... But I want to hear more.
I want to do the whole story. Yeah. I mean, it's a story that, like, continues to grow. The original story is pretty great in the first place, but it seems like it just keeps going. And it's not over, so, but I'll start back at the beginning. So, our story starts with Kevin Manis, who posted an ad on eBay in September 2001 for a haunted box. Now, Kevin had originally bought this wine cabinet from a estate sale of a 103-year-old woman. She was a Holocaust survivor from Poland, and the seller was actually her granddaughter, who's the one who actually described it to Kevin as a Dybbuk box. So
did she say it was haunted?
I don't think so. I think she was, like, kind of gave that feeling to it, but I guess Dybbuk is a Jewish word, and Kevin was Jewish, and he knew this word from childhood, that it was, like, that meant, like, some sort of demon or evil spirit, but he didn't really, like, take it seriously. He was just kind of like, oh, whatever. I mean, he dealt in antiques, and I don't know if he was necessarily, you know, that type of stuff was necessarily on his mind, but it didn't really seem to affect him. It kind of continued that way for a long time, despite all the things that were sort of happening. So I think she gave an impression, but I don't think it really landed on him till later, like, what she was sort of, I don't know, emoting to him. But yeah, so he takes it back to his antique shop, and he takes it down to his basement where he's got, like, a workshop and, like, a large storage area. Like, I think it's, like, pretty big, like 4,000 square feet of just, like, you know, lamps and all sorts of stuff like that. But this cabinet, it's like a wine cabinet. I don't know if you've seen pictures of it, but it's like a small cabinet. It's kind of decorated. I think it's got, like, grapes on it or something like that. But it's got, like, a double doors, but they were locked. And so he actually breaks open the lock on it. And when he does that, the doors kind of, like, open on their own, which is, like, kind of creepy.
What?
He still didn't really think that was weird. He thought it was just some sort of mechanism. But he did feel this, like, really cold wind that sort of came over him when he did that. And then he starts digging in in the box and finds that it's got a bunch of like weird objects in it. Stuff like there's like two pennies, a candlestick, a wine goblet, a stone statue with shalom carved into it, and some hair. And he thinks this is just like sentimental objects from somebody. Again, he doesn't really think too much of it. And then I think he just leaves it, and then I think it's either that day or sometime later, he leaves his store running errands. And then while he's out, he gets this phone call from one of his salespeople. And she basically is like kind of freaking out. And she says she's down in the basement and that there's someone or something down there wrecking the place, like smashing glasses and just like, you know, trashing the whole downstairs.
Like it's going on.
It's going on
as
she speaks, but she can't see this person. And she's positive that she's alone down there. So she's kind of losing her shit because, you know, she doesn't know what's going on. So she's like, come down now, you know. So he comes over there, and I think by the time he had gotten there, whatever was happening had stopped. But when he goes downstairs, it was completely dark because whatever it was had smashed, I think there was like 20 fluorescent lights, right? It's a big place. It's like a storage warehouse or whatever, had smashed out all of those lights. And the whole place smelled like cat urine, it's going to turn out to be a sort of recurring theme here. And then he finds this salesperson, and she's on this. Actually, this is part of this is covered on a episode of Paranormal Witness, and she's on there, and she's like definitely like this like no nonsense chick. And all she says to him when he gets back is "fuck you," and then she leaves, and she never comes back. And like that's the end of their relationship there. Definitely don't blame her for leaving. But he still doesn't really make a connection. But I don't know. I mean, you think in the moment unless you're like really thinking about this stuff all the time.
Well, you're like, let's see, I just bought a demon box.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think we might be a little suspicious at this point, but I don't know. For somebody that's not on their mind, you know, he still doesn't make any sort of connection. So much so that I think within a day or so, a few days later, I'm not sure exactly the amount of time, but it's his mom's birthday, and she actually stops by the shop. And so he's decided for some reason, I don't know why, to give it to her for her birthday, right? So he gives it to her for her birthday, and then he steps away for some reason, leaving her with the box alone, right? And so she has this sort of moment with us and with it. And so when she sits down from sort of across from it, she says that she feels like it's like staring at her. And so she gets up and kind of starts like inspecting it or something. She touches it and maybe she opens it or somehow it comes open. And she has the same experience of this cold wind coming over her. But it's so overwhelming that she kind of like sits down and goes into a swoon. And then quickly realizes she's having a stroke. And so...
Holy shit.
Yeah, so she sort of, like, becomes paralyzed. And I think one of the salespeople finds her, goes, runs, and gets him, and brings him back. And they realize, you know, she's having a straight-up medical emergency, but she can't talk. And so the whole time, she's, like, freaking out, and her eyes are, like, looking around, trying to, like, signal him, you know, that something's going on here. And she says later, she recounts that, like, she feels like... you know, she's just she wants to warn him. She thinks, you know, if this thing has done something to her, it's gonna, you know, she doesn't know what it's gonna do to him. But she can't talk, so she's totally losing her mind. I think later in the hospital, she actually spells out with one of those spelling boards, like where you like look at the letters or point to the letters or whatever, that she hates the gift. She just says hates gift. You know, so he still doesn't like.
Would have preferred a Macy's gift card.
Yes, yes, to a demon. So now he's like, fuck this thing. I need to get rid of it. Like, he doesn't know what to do with it. But, you know, like most people in this situation, I don't know why they always try to give it to their, like, families or friends or something, you know? So
right.
He tries to give it away, and everyone returns it. He even tries to sell it to this couple, but they return it, like, put it on his, like, door stoop or whatever, a few days later with a note that says, "This has an odd darkness about it."
Whoa.
Yeah.
So they're all having experiences,
yes,
too.
So now he knows something's going on, but he doesn't know what to do with it. He can't keep it at the shop, right? It's trashed the place already. He can't sell it. So the next step is he takes it home, right?
Oh, okay. That wouldn't be my next step.
Right. Yeah, mine either. But so as soon as he takes it home, he starts having these nightmares. And these nightmares are another recurring theme. It's almost kind of like one of the like feature phenomenon that sort of happen with people who come into contact with this box. And the dream is that he would start out walking with someone he knew, or he was sort of talking to them, and then he would look into their eyes and he would see something sort of evil staring back at them. And then that person would transform into this demonic hag who would start chasing him and beating him. And these beatings were so bad in these dreams that I think even the first time he had it, he woke up and had like bruises all over his body. So this keeps happening for like a while. And I think even when his family comes to stay the night, they have the same dreams. And then it actually turns out, you know, once this starts coming out, that his girlfriend had the dreams like when he tried to like, I think he gave it to her to keep for a little while or something like that. But so now it's like they're having this verified phenomenon between each other. And around this time, he also starts seeing shadow people in his house, you know, moving shadows, even people visiting are seeing these things. And I think towards the end, he even wakes up, you know, one night with something breathing on his neck. Keeps seeing shadow people, keeps smelling the smell of cat urine and jasmine flowers. So finally he's like, I think this thing's like making him ill. So finally he's like, forget it. I got to look into this thing. I got to get rid of it. So he's like, fuck this. I'm going to put it on eBay. Right. And I think at this point,
oh my God.
Yeah. I think at this point he's looked into like what a Dybbuk is and like what this thing might be. And like, so he does advertise it as a haunted box, you know, and he writes, I think like several pages like detailing exactly what happened to him, because he's not trying to trick somebody. He's not trying to fuck somebody over. He's just like, I got to get rid of this thing. I don't know what to do with it. I think one thought is like not putting it on the street. Like if you throw it away, someone else might get it. So he's in a weird way, I think, trying to be responsible.
Is there a reason why he doesn't want to destroy it?
Well, I don't know. Like, you know, so if this thing's like bound to this box, if you destroy it, is it then released? Like, you know, I don't know. I think you would be careful. I mean, if this thing is like that powerful that it's having this horrible effect on you, I think it would be hard to even touch it, much less take a, you know, attack it. Mm. You don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I would do, but I mean, I kind of sympathize with him a little bit.
Yeah. Okay.
So in June 2003, a University of Missouri student named, I'm not sure if I'm going to get his name right, Losif Nitzik, purchases it, I think thinking that he would do a diary and sort of blog about his experiences with it. Sounds kind of crazy. I mean, guy's young, and, you know, like, he's also depicted in that episode of Paranormal Witness as, you know, kind of cavalier about the whole thing. So much so that, you know, he actually sleeps with this thing in his room, and his roommate even describes it as like him having taunted it. So naturally he soon starts having these horrible dreams about this hag. He gets ill, he gets depressed, he starts having insomnia, his hair starts falling out, right? His roommate recounts seeing bugs crawling all over this thing. They get like an infestation in their house. All their electronics starts going crazy and stuff. So finally, 8 months after he purchases it, he can't take it anymore, so he puts it back on eBay. And so at this point, he sells it to Jason Haxton for $280. Now, Jason was the director of some type of medical museum or something on the campus that the other guy had actually been going to, and I think he had been following him on the blog the whole time, so he knows the story. He knows even, I think, some of the backstory, and he's sort of eager to try to explore it scientifically if you can, you know. So he like tests this thing. He like he does like black lights on it. He tests it for heavy metals and mercury, and you know he's trying to figure out.
Huh? It's like in the movies where they have like the paranormal department of a university, and there's some tweety professor who's right, all right. like,
"It's like that."
Yes, yeah, so I wrote this book.
Yes, and I think he eventually did write a book about it, actually. But basically, he's trying to figure out, is this thing making people sick because it's contaminated or something? You know, is there some like toxic contamination that's like, you know, heavy metal or something weird that's actually making what people sick? He can't find anything. But in the meantime, I think it's somewhere in the museum or in a lab or something like this, all the electronics in, you know, his coworkers' area start breaking down. His staff starts feeling like depleted of energy, and they're just like, they don't like having this fucking thing around. So they're like, get it out of here. So finally he's like, I don't know what to do with it. Same sort of story. So naturally he takes it home. Now, once he starts doing that, he starts having the same terrible dreams. They're a little different. It was definitely still with this hag that would beat him, but he would have these reoccurring images of her face with these like horrible wounds in it. And no matter how many times he would wake up, he'd go back to sleep and have these images like going through his mind over and over again. I think he gets pretty sick. I don't remember exactly what he has, but... So one night in his living room, he's there with his son. I think he has a whole family there. Like, I think his wife and children or child or whatever. But his son turns to him and says, you know, what's that? And he looks over and there's this black mass in the middle of the room with these, he describes it as these black flames licking at the wall. And then he's like, okay, I gotta get the fuck out of here, you know. So he takes it to some property and buries it away in this basement. And when he does this, he has this like really like sick, strange feeling and this like strange wind that's sort of blowing over him as he does it. But he's like, okay, fine, it's away, it's not near us. So he goes home and like takes this bath to like cleanse it away from him. And when that happens, like, he starts coughing and like coughs up blood or some sort of like gross stuff. And then his wife's like banging at the door. And then she comes in and she's got these like weird blisters all over her wrists. And so at that point he's like, okay, I've got it away, but like, I got to figure out what the fuck's going on here. Like, we're still having these like experiences. So he goes and calls Kevin, who's the original owner. And so at first Kevin's like, hell no, I don't have anything to do with this, you know. You know, I told y'all what it was going to do. But I think eventually he agrees to help. So now Kevin goes back to see the granddaughter that he originally bought this from. And, you know, I think immediately she's like, nope, go away, goodbye. But there's this other woman there, like he's at her house. And there's this other woman there who's like, all right, look, I'll talk to you. And she turns out to be the, I think, the cousin of the grandmother. And she's like, all right, I'm going to tell you the story. So basically, she tells him the story of the origin of the box. You ready for it?
Yes.
Okay. okay, so, you know, back at the turn of the century, like, spiritualism's all the rage. You know, anybody who's anybody is doing seances, right? So that's what's happening. And so the grandmother and I think one of her friends and maybe the cousin, they're all into this stuff, right? And I think they're pretty young. But they have this game. I think it's not a Ouija board, but it's kind of like that. It's this, it's like constructed out of this like pendulum, but it basically does the same thing, right? You hold a seance, you ask questions, and this pendulum will sort of spell out answers, and that's how they start communicating with this some sort of spirit, right? And they learn that this spirit is, yeah, I think they assume or learn that this spirit's like kind of evil or demonic or something, and it wants them to bring it from the other side into this world. And so for some reason that I cannot fathom, they decide to do this, but trap it inside a box, right? That's their plan. And so they devise this whole ceremony in which they call this spirit forth and then seal it using some sort, I think if there's some sort of like Jewish mystical sort of Hasidic thing going on here. I'm not exactly sure what the origin of what they did was, but they do some sort of ceremony where they like seal it with wax or something like that and trap this thing in this box. And so they immediately kind of realize that they've made a absolute horrible mistake, right? Well, first of all, don't fuck with Ouija boards. That should be like really like lesson one. Like, I feel like all the worst Absolutely. Stories here are always yeah. start with Ouija boards.
Like, well, it's like, isn't the thinking like basically the only thing that you're going to connect with is going to be something up to no good? Because right. that's what's hanging around.
Right. Or you just don't know what you're going to get. You're calling a payphone in some other land. Like, you have no idea who's going to pick up that phone. And so, so they realize that, like, this is a big problem. So they basically just seal it away, stow it away, and the grandmother keeps it sealed and away from everybody for the rest of her life, right? And that's when, you know, basically when she dies, the granddaughter sells it. And the granddaughter, I think they kind of know a little bit, but they don't really know the full story, but they know it's something to stay away from. So after he learns about this story, he reaches out to a rabbi who helps him seal it back up, and then he puts it back. I think he buries it away somewhere or puts it in some basement somewhere and locks it away, and says he's never going to let anyone touch it, or see it ever again, right? Story doesn't end there. He does. So the epilogue is that he eventually does sell the box to Zach Baggins, I guess that's how you say it, from Ghost Hunters. Do you know this guy? I think I've seen like an episode of this or something. And he sells it for his haunted museum in Las Vegas.
Okay. I've heard about this museum.
Oh, you have? Okay. So this is like the like most haunted centerpiece of this place. I guess I don't know all the details of it, but I guess he's had like a couple specials about this box. One of them, hilariously, was with Post Malone. So they actually like open up this thing's like in a glass case, and they like open up the glass case, and I think he like touches it or something, and he says it like he has this feeling of all the fear you would have in your life all at once, and then he like. Like, Post Malone's there, and he, like, I don't know if he touches or he touches him, but then Post Malone, like, absolutely loses his shit. And, like, basically now he swears that he's cursed by this box. He, like, recounts all this bad stuff that happened to him. It's you know, you have to take it all with a grain of salt, you know, both of them, really. Like, it's hard to be like, well, Post Malone, right. like, I don't know what he was doing with
Vegas.
His life. in the first place, but he definitely feels that way. And, you know, again, with, you know, Zach Baggins, he is a television personality, but... You know, he does hold another special where they're going to open it up. And, you know, I think they have like a rabbi there who's going to seal it back for them once they do. And then they find
they
out.
They need to not open that up.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't. At the end, okay. I think they learn that the rabbi doesn't really believe in the whole thing. And that I think that kind of throws them off a little bit. And then he's so scared of this thing that he doesn't open it. And so that's so it now remains sealed in the glass case. In this haunted museum, and I think people even say they still see shadow people in the room that it's kept.
But supposedly the glass makes it safe
for
the viewing public?
I guess so.
Okay.
And that's the story of the Dybbuk box.
Wow, that is super creepy.
Yeah, isn't it?
It's very creepy.
It's super creepy, and just like, I don't know.
Don't buy haunted devil boxes, guys.
Don't buy haunted devil boxes. Stay away from Ouija boards. Don't mess around with Post Malone. Just stay at home.
All of that.
Yeah, all of that
all
stuff.
Of that.
So.
Wow.
Pretty crazy,
Yikes.
Huh?
Really crazy.
And I feel like it's like that story, like, it's kind of like Annabelle, where it's like, people over a certain amount of time, they're like, look, we can't explain what the hell this thing is. Something's happening here, and we gotta respect it. Right? Like, people don't fuck around with Annabelle anymore, right? Like, they have all, like, I think you have to sign a waiver when you go into that haunted museum. But with, like, Annabelle, like, they're like, do not take a picture of Annabelle without asking her. You know, like, because enough stuff has happened.
Wasn't that Robert?
There's Robert Doll? Tube.
You can't take a picture of him either without asking.
Oh.
Maybe that's a thing. I'm conflating with like
them, maybe that's just like a thing with haunted
like
dolls.
Like haunted dolls. Like they don't really.
You gotta get permission.
Right.
But anyways, like I think people are starting to like, obviously you can't explain what this thing is, but people are starting to grow some respect for it or some, you know, knowing that they just can't fuck around with it. So, anyways.
Well, I wouldn't go anywhere near it.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, I don't know. If I went there, I don't know if I'd... Maybe I would go into the Haunted Museum.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe. Anyways. Okay, you want to do your story?
Yes. So, my story is interesting. I was thinking about a haunted doll, but I'm like, no, it's too on the nose. So, I am doing the Talman Haunted Bunk Bed.
Whoa.
Have you heard of this one?
No.
Okay. So basically, it all starts out in 1986. Deborah and Alan Talman and their three young children move into what, at the time, I'm sure they thought was their dream house, on a quiet street called Larrabee Street in, and I'm going to butcher this name, Horicon, Wisconsin. But it's in like a quiet neighborhood, and at the time, the house was only 4 years old. So, not a whole lot of time
so
to, like
brand
be haunted.
Yeah.
Basically new. So, they move in, and only a short time later, in early February of 1987, the family purchased a bunk bed from a secondhand shop for $100. And this was for, they have two young daughters who I think are like one and two or something like this, but this is for their bedroom. And so, this thing is stored in the basement at first, but then a few months later in May of 1987, they assemble it, they bring it upstairs into the girls' bedroom, and that is when strange events started happening. So, on the very first night that the bunk bed was upstairs, they had a little boy also, and his bedroom is right next door to the girls' room, and when he was going to sleep, he said that his clock radio turned on by itself and began, like, switching through the channels. And so he's, like, trying to tell his parents this, and they didn't believe him, you know. Probably thought it was imagination or something like that. It's quiet for a few weeks, but a few weeks later, Alan is painting the basement walls. And he went upstairs for a break, have lunch or something like that. And before he did, he placed his paintbrush on the table and goes upstairs, has lunch, comes back down, and the brush is now in the paint bucket with the bristles sticking straight up. So, that's weird.
But it's not too weird.
You can kind of come up with like, oh, okay, maybe, you know, maybe I forgot. Something like that.
I mean, I feel like these things always seem weirder in retrospect. Like, if that happens, you wouldn't think like, oh, there's a ghost. Like, you're just like, huh. That's weird, you know, like...
I mean, yeah, I thought I had it on the table, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So next, and this is really weird because our stories are like in this way. The youngest daughter said that when she was in bed, she saw a witch-like old woman with long black hair who glowed like fire standing by her door. So she saw some like creepy hag lady. And a month later, the son said he saw the same thing.
That's
so
creepy.
Yeah, I feel like it's super creepy.
Yeah, I feel like with the kids, like if they're both saying they saw this, like one, like you'd be like, yeah, okay, you know, but like two seeing the same thing, that would start to, I don't know.
So yeah, but by this time, there's also like other things happening. So doors are opening and banging shut. They hear footsteps they can't account for. There's nobody there. Eerie voices calling out. And they call the family pastor. And his name is Wayne Dobretz or something like that. Anyway, they bring the pastor in. And he definitely gets bad vibes and thinks it's demonic activity. But he blesses the house. You know, says a prayer. And things seem to quiet down for a little bit. But not for long. So the noises, everything is back again, and the family's seeing ghostly apparitions. And both Deborah and the children began having nightmares at this point in time. And then the children, who are always like in really good health, they didn't get sick or anything, they're starting to get ill more often, having like health problems that they didn't have before, and there's no good explanation for. So it's only been a few months in, and a week before Christmas, the son saw something that scared him. And when I was doing my research, I couldn't find out what it was, but he basically tells his parents like he wants to move out. And at this point, Alan gets really just pissed off and loses it, and just like yells at the parents, like, or excuse me, yells at the spirits to get out of the house, and that if they want to fight someone, they should fight him and leave his kids alone, leave his family alone. So he has this outburst, but it doesn't stop anything.
Yeah, usually that like makes it worse or something.
I mean, he was, obviously lost his temper, he's
Right.
getting freaked out, getting scared. So on January 7th, around 2 a.m. In 1988, Alan returned home from working the late shift. And he said he heard this weird howling sound coming from the outside garage area, goes to check it out, and basically hears a voice that says, "Come here." And he looks and he sees two eyes kind of like glowing on the garage door. So like naturally he did what, everybody would do in the situation. He leaves and he goes and checks it out, which I wouldn't do. But he and so he like goes outside the garage, nobody's there. But when he goes back into the garage, he sees that it's on fire. So he
The
runs
garage
inside
is on fire.
the garage is now on fire.
Oh, shit.
So, like, in the moment when he left to check this thing out, suddenly the garage bursts into flames. So he runs inside to get a fire extinguisher, comes back, there's no fire.
Wait,
So,
what? Oh, he just saw this as this is like a hallucination or something like
some
that.
kind of
Right.
vision or
Right.
something like that. Yeah, there actually wasn't a fire, but he thought there was. So Alan starts sleeping in his daughter's room to protect them, and probably so they won't be scared. And one night he said he saw a misty figure. It's kind of like foggy, sort of like a smoky looking apparition. It appears in the room, and a voice comes out of it that says, "You're dead." And he sees these green eyes and flames appear before it completely disappears.
Whoa.
Yeah. And they're still living here, though.
See,
All of the things that are
that
happening.
th then I would be like, okay, fuck it, we're going to Holiday Inn. Let's get the
Yeah, I
fuck
know
out of here.
this is not worth it. But because all of this wasn't enough, yet to convince them to leave, a few days later, Alan was working late again, and he asked a relative to watch the kids. Now, this relative was known to be a skeptic, didn't buy into any of this stuff, didn't believe in any paranormal anything, wasn't afraid. But when he was putting the kids to bed in that bedroom, he saw the same terrifying hag-like figure that had appeared to the children, and I guess like screamed and completely became a believer.
Wow.
So at this point, Deborah decides to take the kids and leave. And 2 weeks later, the Talmans apparently thought that, okay, when did all of this start happening? What was the turning point here? And they link it all back to the bunk bed. So they take it out, they destroy it, and they bury it in a landfill. And to this day, nobody knows where, but in
Oh,
a
wow.
landfill somewhere where no one's ever going to uncover it. After this, all the phenomena came to an abrupt halt. But they were obviously super creeped out by this house, and they'd wanted to move out anyway. So, because it had been so soon after they just bought it, they lost about $3,000 in the deal. But they move out, and another family moved in 1988, but didn't experience any hauntings, nothing out of the ordinary. And you know, to this day, there have never been any reported incidences in this house. So it appears that it really was tied to this creepy ghostly bunk bed.
So random, like a bunk bed.
It's kind of funny.
Like a wine cabinet or, you know, some like weird thing. Yeah, and it sounds
something that
creepy
seems
in the first
a little
place.
Scarier. But, yeah. Yeah. But it's like a bunk bed. And I mean, some people have proposed that, you know, this is a hoax, you know, maybe they're trying to get attention, but basically it was a media frenzy after word got out about this in this town, but the Tallmans didn't court public attention and they wanted to keep their kids out of the media. Alan and Debbie turned down a $5,000 bid to sell their story to the National Enquirer. They also turned down a chance to appear on the Oprah Winfrey Show, even.
Wow.
You got to think, you know, they're obviously like, you know, not willing to go super public with it. They did end up having their story told on in the first season of Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, okay.
So, but it was like reenactments played by Milwaukee actors. You know, they weren't in it. But the news, meanwhile, has like spread through the area and spawned all of these crazier stories even. So people are saying that like blood oozes from the ceiling in the house, that there's a portal to hell in the basement. And this one cracks me up, that there was a ghost snowblower that would clear the driveway all by itself. Which maybe you'd want. I don't know. Especially in Wisconsin in the winter.
Yeah. Like, fuck it, let's do it. Yeah.
Right. That's not so bad. But so the stories attracted not only the media, but thrill seekers and mobs of people who would congregate on Larrabee Street hoping for a supernatural experience of their own. And the local police chief, his name was Douglas Glayman, met with the family. He's getting really tired of, you know, this mob of people hanging around and the media circus. And so he just kind of wanted to get to the bottom of this. But after hearing their story, he thought they were sincere. He was interested in protecting them from the press and everything. So what he tells them to do is to just be really selective, share their story with the press to quell the media frenzy, you know, put something out there. And like, hopefully everything would die down, which it eventually did. But yeah, to this day, there have been no other reports, as far as I could find, in that house. And that is the story of the haunted bunk bed.
Wow. That's so random, though. But, I mean, it sounds scary. Like, the glowing eyes and, like, I don't know, seeing the hag and...
I think that creepy hag. I wonder if it's like a similar hag. Like, is that a
thing?
That
is funny that we both had one.
I've never heard of that before.
I have. I mean, you know, especially with the like, you know, the whole sleep paralysis thing. And I mean, there's that's definitely a figure that comes up in, you know, a lot of ghost stories and stuff like this. You know, but there is something interesting about it. I mean, you know, I mean, first of all, just the fact that like, a lot of the naysayers, they immediately always go to, oh, people are trying to get attention. But, you know, for these, like, you know, normal families, like, I mean, most of this stuff is very upsetting and disruptive to their lives. You know, like, who would want any of that, you know?
Right. The one explanation that I saw that I would be willing to buy would be, you know, some people were speculating that maybe they were in over their heads and they wanted to get rid of the house and get out of it, so they concocted this whole thing. But that's kind of a lot. It's a lot. You know, it's the long game if you're trying to do that.
It's
a
lot. And I mean, it's not like people, you know, there's not somebody out there that wouldn't do it. But I feel like going straight to that, you're just always circumventing what people's experiences are, right? No matter how many naysayers there are, or like, attention seekers or whatever, these stories pervade like history, you know, like these stories, you know, like about hags, about hauntings, about all this stuff, you know, it's certainly nothing new. And it's part of the human experience. I mean, people see these things, you know, with the Dybbuk box, and a lot of the naysayers are like, well, oh, it's all psychosomatic. You know, the one guy had this experience and then everyone else expected it to have the experience. So then they had it. But then that's also bizarre. Do you know what I mean? Like, if this is really all hallucinations that are caused by an idea, that's also kind of crazy, right?
I mean, it is crazy. The fact that the mind could have that much power.
Right. That would be something beyond that we understand, right? Like, I mean, you know, from the point of view of hallucinations, I mean, seeing something like that, that's a pretty intense hallucination. You know what I mean? Like, people on, like, LSD or something don't see stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, a building burning and then it isn't there and then it is there. Like, that's pretty intense. Maybe they do. But, I mean, that's still a pretty intense level of hallucination. That's not something that you just, oops, like, ooh, I saw something weird out of the corner of my eye. Right? That's a totally different state of mind. And I don't know. I mean, I just think that, like, there's always, I think, value in just taking the people's experiences at face value and just, it's not like, oh, well, now this proves there's ghosts. No, it doesn't prove that. I mean, just like our story about, you know, aliens, it doesn't prove that, but it does, it is something in and of itself, and it's worth, you know, discussing. It's worth investigating, I think, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, why does stuff like this happen? It's so weird, right? Like, why would this thing be in a bunk bed? Why would a couple girls try to channel a spirit into a box? You know what I mean? Why would all these people have these nightmares? Like, what is that? What's going on? You know what I mean?
Is it right? Maybe it's something that no one has even thought of before.
Yeah, maybe it's
some other explanation is some other dimension, something going on.
Yeah, is it some weird dimension?
Will one day be explained by science?
Yeah, like the shadow people thing. You know, a lot of people think those are like interdimensional things, and maybe it's just energies. Maybe it's just echoes of, you know, energies and vibrations of things that have happened before, but that's still weird. I mean, I think it just speaks to the porousness of reality, you know? And I think the more that we get into things like string theory and things like that, we start to understand just how porous and flimsy what we call the sort of solid reality that we live in is. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
So, well, cool. I mean, that was a great story. I really like that. I think I'm going to try and watch that episode.
Yeah, apparently it's kind of hard to find.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. All right. Well, that's our third episode.
Yeah. Oh, and everybody, please send us your ghost stories.
Yes.
We are going to do a little mini episode compiled of listener ghost stories.
Yes, so we're super looking forward to hearing yours and want to be able to read as many as we can on the show. And I think coming up, I don't know, we have a couple themes coming up. If you even want to send us stories for those, I think we're thinking about maybe the Bermuda Triangle or what were some of the other ones we were thinking of? Synchronicity, I think maybe we'll do that one later, but Bermuda Triangle is definitely...
Yeah, Bermuda Triangle, I feel like we need to do that. Well, yeah, it's still summer.
Yes.
It feels like a summer.
Yeah, like a tropical one.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, cool. I feel like that was good. Are you good?
I'm good, yeah.
Okay. Until next time.
All right. See you later.
Bye.